So this is part of a series on Halacha meets modernity. And for my part of the series, the first one was about physical discoveries and dealing with new discoveries, and we dealt with a Tchelet question. Not so much the question of is it valid or is it not valid, but how do you deal with new physical realities and new discoveries? How do you integrate that into your view of Halacha? And for this one, I wanted to talk about new social values, changes in the way society thinks. And then the next one, God willing, in 2 weeks, will be reacting to the Chote, and that will be new religious values. What happens when people's conception of how religion, and particularly Judaism, works, what happens within society, and how does Halacha respond to that? So the funny thing with this topic is that I started out with patient autonomy as my focus, because that's a topic I know from medicine, and I've given shiurim on patient autonomy before, but I quickly realized that that was too narrow, and we had to talk about medical decision-making at large. And that's because medical decision-making really comprises three different elements. Number one, the options. What are your options for what you could do for the patient? Treating, withholding treatment, withdrawing treatment, treating symptoms, euthanasia, all the different options for dealing with a patient. The second is the factors involved. The factors that the doctor has to take into consideration, or whoever's making the decision. Whether that's the danger of the condition, the danger of the treatment, the patient's pain, physical pain, emotional pain, dignity, finances, lack of medical clarity sometimes, and so on. And then the third factor is the authority, what we usually think of in terms of patient autonomy, the question of who makes the final decision. Is it the doctor? Is it the patient? The substitute decision maker? God? Whoever it is, who's going to make this decision on how to treat the patient? So we're going to have to actually talk about not just patient autonomy, which comes under sort of the very narrow field of the authority, who's making the decisions, but also how those decisions are made, because all of those are affected by social values. Now, in order to do this, you have to really begin a step back and ask the question of whether social values ever affect halacha. Meaning ever. Is there such a concept that the way I observe a mitzvah today is going to change in 100 years if society changes its perspective on things? What would you say? Yes. Can you give me an example? Where is there a halacha that changes as society changes its values? Yes, Amram. So you're saying that the Gemara does say that in a time when the nations are trying to drive us away from Judaism, so any act which would seem to be an acceptance of the way the nations do things, like how one ties one shoelace, would be considered a violation, and that's subject to social values. Okay, that's an interesting example of it. It's an interesting example. I think let me say it more broadly. There's a general protocol for determining halacha in a particular case. The application of halacha to a particular situation requires that you know the realities involved. So, whether that's medical information, financial information, the scope of the issue involved, does it affect one person, a family, a community? These are all factors you need to be aware of, and social values may be one of those realities. I gave you a couple of examples on the sheet that I hope will make this more concrete. There is a halacha called Kavod HaBriyot. Kavod HaBriyot, human dignity. And the rule is, as the Gemara states, Kavod HaBriyot, human dignity, overrides rabbinic prohibitions, right? It overrides Lo Sa'aseh Shabbat Torah, as the Gemara says. It overrides a biblical prohibition, which is the one that says Lo Tasur, that you should not stray from the words of the Rabbanan. And the Gemara says, therefore, human dignity overrides rabbinic prohibitions. The question arises, is that an unlimited overriding? Meaning, what if I decide that my dignity requires, fill in the blank, whatever it is. Within my dignity, maybe I don't know, wearing a four-cornered garment, wearing tzitzis, is going to mess up the look of my clothing, and I feel that it's undignified for me. That's not a great example, maybe, since it's Raisa versus Derabbanan. But what if I decide, you can fill in the blank on anything, what if I decide that it is within my dignity, I'm trying to think of a better example. Well, there again, I'm getting towards potential Del Raisa. Depends if it's an internal combustion engine or not, and how I hold on stepping on the gas pedal. Sorry? If I decide that eating chicken and cheese is, well, let's say I have a bunch of coworkers, and this is a ridiculous example, but I have a bunch of coworkers, and within my place of work, they all go out for chicken and cheese, and that's going to be a derabbanan. I'm going to say, well, if I miss that, if I'm not involved in that, that's going to harm my dignity. That's a little bit of a ludicrous example, perhaps. I'll give a better example. I'll give another example that actually gets discussed. They ask the question of somebody who has some kind of an accident and his fingertip is damaged on Shabbos. And there's no danger to his life. His life will be fine. However, in the event that he waits to get it treated until after Shabbos, then it won't be treated as well. If you wait a certain period of time after the injury, the laceration, whatever it is, there will be a scar. So the type of treatment you would give him on Shabbos in order to avoid the scar would be itself a derabbanan. You have a way that you could close it up on Shabbos, violating only a derabbanan, and that way you would preserve his dignity. And he says, having such a scar would violate my dignity. That's his argument. So how many people do you need to have in order to determine that's my dignity? What if you polled 100 people and 5 of them would say, I don't want to have a scar, and it shames me to have a scar? You know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is cited in the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa as talking about if you have a runny nose, the possibility of being able to violate a derabbanan in terms of transporting a tissue in order to be able to blow your nose as you walk on Shabbos. So, you know, is having a runny nose a violation of Kvod Ebrios? If you take a look at source number 1, Rav Eliyahu Bakshi Daron in his Binyan Av writes, "Kvod Abrios lo nema rak hechashi gnai l'chol hamin ha'enoshi." He says, Kvod Abrios, this idea of dignity, is specifically where failure to do this would result in something that would disgrace any human being. Sherov b'nei adam misbaishim bazeh, that most people would be embarrassed by. Kamo lelech bashuk arum, right? Walking around without clothing in the marketplace, in the case that the Gemara brings, where you know that the person has shatnez in his garment, and if you tell him not to wear it, then he's going to have to walk around without clothing on. Aval darash shabizah, but if it's only embarrassing to this one guy, because of his personal traits, he's very sensitive, and it's not relevant to exempt him from whatever the case is at hand because of human dignity. In other words, it's subject to social values in general, but those will change. In one generation, it's embarrassing to walk around with a runny nose. In another generation, it's not embarrassing at all. Or I gave you another example on the sheath, the issue of kli gever, right? The Torah prohibits men from wearing women's clothing, women from wearing men's clothing. So that's an example, again, where it's dependent on social values. I brought you, in the interest of time, I'm going to abbreviate a bit, but the Shulchan Aruch is the one that says right there, defining a woman's garb, b'makom she'ein loshim osan hakelim, in a place where men don't wear those garments, only women do it, misimen osan chali elanashim, a place where only women do that. And not only that, Rabbi Yeshua Falk in his Prisha, commenting on the tour, says social values doesn't mean Jewish social values. Social values means what the world wears. So if your average non-Jewish male on the street wears this, then it's no longer a woman's garment, right? The classic discussion from when I was a kid, were earrings considered to be women's garments or not? So it's not about what Jewish men wear. It's about what men in society wear as a whole. That's another example where it's contingent on social values. The third example that I brought you in source number 4 is from the Shulchan Aruch regarding respectful clothing for davening. Respectful clothing for davening is determined by Derech Anshei Hamakom, the way of local people in general and what they would wear if they were in front of a respected person, not necessarily Queen Elizabeth, but a respected person in general. And there are other examples that we could go into. The point is that many halachos are indeed affected by social norms. Some things are not affected by social norms. I would love at some point to do a series on this, try to figure out which ones do change and which ones don't change. For example, Kriya Shema, right? Zman Kriya Shema in the morning is determined by Bekumecha, when you rise. And the Gemara tells us that the time of Kima, Zman Kima, the time when people rise, is the first 3 hours of the day. What if you live in a place where that's just not true? Where Zman Kima is earlier, Zman Kima is later. Does that change? The answer is no. We have an absolute value. It doesn't make a difference where you are. Even if you live in a place where it has nothing to do with when the sun rises, like you live in Alaska or whatever it is, nonetheless, that's the rule. It doesn't appear to change. There are others where it doesn't appear to change, and I'm not clear on why it's so. It doesn't distinguish based on Del Reis or Derabbanan. It's not based on clear criteria that I can identify. Okay. But let's get to our case, medical decision making. So as I said in the beginning, there are three parts to a medical decision. There are the options for treatment, or non-treatment as the case may be. There are the factors that you're going to weigh in making the decision. Physical pain, emotional pain, danger from the treatment, finances, whatever. And then there's the authority. Who is it who's going to actually make the decision? The patient, the doctor, the SDM, the rabbi, who is it going to be? So historically, just in terms of the authority aspect of things, historically, who was the one who would make the decision? The doctor. This goes all the way back to the time of the Greeks. Right? The Greek system of paternalism in general. The Greeks said that if you want to have a good political system, I'm going back to Plato's Republic, you get a few people who are trained in and skilled in diplomacy, and they run the show on behalf of the common people, because the common people don't know what they're talking about. When the common people go to the polls, you end up with certain people as your president. That's what happens. Plato did not trust the individual. You go with the people who are trained, who are knowledgeable. Hippocrates applied this to the doctor situation. If you take a look at source number 6, the instructions of Hippocrates: fulfill your obligation to the patient in tranquility and for his benefit. Most matters should be withheld from the patient when you treat him. Instruct the patient in a pleasant and positive manner, but divert his mind from what is being done for him. At times you must deflect the patient's mind in a sharp manner, whereas other times you should calm his mind, but without revealing to him his true condition or the prognosis. Very paternalistic. The doctor will take care of you. You don't worry your pretty little head about it. We've got it all under control. We won't tell the patient. And of course, you're probably aware that within halacha, this was the system for a very long time, and to a certain extent remains the system. The idea of not informing a patient of a terminal diagnosis because it would harm the patient's hope, and it would just trouble him, and without benefit. That doesn't always work that way. That's a shiur in its own right. But what Hippocrates is saying, you know, is not foreign to halacha. When you move into the 19th century in North America, the system was still the same. The system was social values. The social values were authority is with the most knowledgeable. That's in terms of authority. In terms of options, I'm going to come back to the authority in a little bit. But in terms of options for what you could do to care for the patient, take a look at source number 7. This was a fascinating article, part of a two-part series. A brief historical and theoretical perspective on patient autonomy and medical decision-making, part 2. Part 1 was the beneficence model, part 2 is the autonomy model. It's a brief article, maybe, but it's not a brief title. So this fellow, Jonathan Will, writes, the intimate nature of the physician-patient relationship, coupled with a medical ethic based in the beneficence model, which was the classic model of I, the doctor, am your benefactor, led to certain unilateral decisions being made by physicians that by today's standards would be viewed as unsettling. Right? So when the doctor was viewed as the one who's going to make the decision on your behalf, they did all sorts of things, some of which we would look at and say, I can't believe they ever allowed that. For instance, physicians might have identified a severely disabled newborn, such as one with spina bifida, as a stillbirth, in order to spare the parents from making a difficult choice, or decided to withhold antibiotics from an elderly person with pneumonia to let the disease, quote, serve as the old man's best friend. I don't know who he's quoting.
Pneumonia is known as the old man's best friend.
Yeah? Okay.
Because it's a nice way to die.
If you say so. It sounds awful like Askara in the Gemara, but okay. But the point is that in terms of options, in 19th century North America, this is consistent with what I've seen elsewhere. The options were, do what you feel is necessary, doctor. Now, there are some caveats to that in terms of the law. The law was not necessarily like that. If you take a look at source number 8 from the Supreme Court of the United States, a case called Washington v. Glucksberg. Washington v. Glucksberg was the classic case on assisted suicide in the state of Washington. So as part of the decision, the court summarized the status of rules against assisted suicide. And it says, the earliest American statute explicitly to outlaw assisting suicide was enacted in New York in 1828. Many of the new states and territories followed New York's example. Between 1857 and 1865, a New York commission led by Dudley Field drafted a criminal code that prohibited aiding a suicide and specifically furnishing another person with any deadly weapon or poisonous drug, knowing that such person intends to use such weapon or drug and taking his own life. So there were limitations, at least on the books, in terms of what the options were for the doctor. But fundamentally, the doctor did what the doctor felt was best. The factors the doctor would consider seemed to be anything and everything, from just the mental state of the patient to the physical pain to finances. Didn't seem to make a difference. The doctor was the one who would make this decision. I brought you a piece from the first code of ethics of the Canadian Medical Association. It's very interesting. The U.S. the AMA developed its first code of ethics in 1847, and it is copied almost word for word in large sections in the Canadian Medical Association's first code of ethics in 1868, because plagiarism, I guess, wasn't on the list of ethics. No, because they were both. Look, I'm sure the American one was copied from someone in Europe. It's not as though they made it up either. But they were all dealing with the same set of problems. They created the code of ethics not because a doctor woke up one day and said, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we had a code of ethics? But they were dealing with certain challenges. One challenge they were dealing with was competition between doctors, and so there's a lot of material there on joint consultations, interference, and so on. Another problem they were dealing with was what they called quackery. The practice of snake oil and all sorts of other recommendations, and trying to defeat that in practice. So they came up with a lot of the same ideas to deal with it. So if you take a look at this piece in source number 9 from the Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics, a physician ought not to abandon a patient because the case is deemed incurable. For his attendance may continue to be highly useful to the patient and comforting to the relatives around him, even to the last period of a fatal malady, by alleviating pain and other symptoms and by soothing mental anguish. In other words, the doctor has to worry about pain, the doctor has to worry about mental anguish, and even where he's not playing a healing role, even where there's nothing he can do anymore in terms of curing the disease, these are some of the factors the doctor has to take into consideration. So he has all the options, basically, although the law doesn't like assisted suicide at that stage. He has a range of factors that he's going to consider. And authority. The authority is with the doctor. I already noted this before outside, but take a look at source number 10, because I really like these sources. Look at this from the CMA code. Again, this piece is lifted directly from the AMA code. Physicians should unite tenderness with firmness and condescension with authority. I have to think condescension meant something different in the middle of the 19th century. It doesn't mean what it means today, but I don't know. And thus inspire their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. That's from the doctor's side. From the patient's side, flip the page. The obedience of a patient to the prescriptions of his physician should be prompt and implicit. He should never permit his own crude opinions as to their fitness to influence his attention to them. Right? Patient, keep your ideas to yourself. A failure in one particular may render an otherwise judicious treatment dangerous, even fatal. This remark is equally applicable to diet, drink, and exercise. This should sound familiar. As patients become convalescent, they are very apt to suppose that the rules prescribed for them may be disregarded. And the consequence, but too often, is a relapse. Nothing changes. The patient decides, I don't need to take the rest of my antibiotics, I don't need to take my whatever it is. So the doctor is the purveyor of science, and you have to listen to your doctor. And again, in number 11, you see what we saw in Hippocrates before. The physician should not make gloomy prognostications as they savor of empiricism. Empiricism was the enemy of the new science of the time. Empiricism is the idea that you know things based on your observation and experience, as opposed to rationalism, which says you use theory and you think things through. So they said that making these gloomy prognostications doesn't seem rational, and magnify the importance of his services to the treatment of the disease. Right? It makes him look important. But he should not fail on proper occasion to give the friends of the patient timely notice of danger when it really occurs, even to the patient himself if absolutely necessary. And then it goes on to say, but really the doctor shouldn't be the one to give the notice. The doctor should find a friend of the patient who's articulate and let the friend be the one to tell him. That's the way that it was done. So that's going back to the 19th century. Shift in a big way when you deal with the modern age. And here we're going to see changes in social values. First of all, maybe the biggest change, well, I don't know if it's the biggest, but certainly a major change in terms of what the options are at the disposal of the doctor. The shift is on. It started in North America in Oregon and Washington. Now it's in Canada. Physician-assisted death, medical assistance in dying, whatever name you want to put on it. The bottom line is that the doctor is expected to consider ending the life of the patient part of the doctor's tool chest. And there was an article today, someone forwarded it to me, that was from today, that someone did a study in Alberta. Sorry?
Save money.
Yes. Canada can save $139 million a year by assisted suicide. Just based on saying how much time will they shave off the person's life and how much would it cost you to take care of that person. I don't know why they stop there. If they kill the person 5 years earlier, they can save five times the money. I don't know what why they have to stop with that. Start at birth. It's the money saver. This represents a significant change in social values. If you take a look at source number 12 from the classic Carter versus Canada decision, which opened up the door to this, it said this is about the patient's liberty and security. Their liberty in terms of the ability to make the decision concerning their bodily integrity and medical care, that's what they need, the freedom to do that, and their security in order to protect themselves from intolerable suffering. So that social values change radically and open up new options for the physician. The factors are basically as they were before. I mean, the doctor is expected to consider all the things that the doctor considered in the 19th century. But the other major change is in the realm of patient autonomy, in the sense that authority shifts to the patient. And here I go back to that brief historical and theoretical perspective article by Jonathan Will, because I thought he summed it up really well. Take a look at source number 13. While physicians did develop a more consistent practice of obtaining patient consent in the early 20th century, the medical literature indicates that the practice was fueled more by a desire to respond to lawsuits than by a moral imperative to respect patient autonomy. It wasn't, we love and respect patients, they must make their own decisions. It was, they're going to sue us if they don't like the decision we made, so we better have them make the decision. In a 1911 article, physician George W. Gay suggested that, quote, careful and explicit explanations of the nature of serious cases, together with the complications liable to arise and their probable termination, be given to the patient for our own protection. In Schloendorf v. Society of New York Hospitals, Justice Cardozo, this is 1915, planted the seed for what would become the informed consent doctrine when he wrote, every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. So he frames it in terms of rights. And a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault for which he is liable in damages. And that, of course, becomes part of the principles of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, as noted in number 14. Respect for the autonomy and personal dignity of the patient is central to the provision of ethically sound patient care. There are some interesting side notes in this. One side note is an article I read which pointed out that what we have today is not really consent. He made a distinction between assent and consent. Assent is, you tell me this is what I think should happen, and I say, okay, I don't really know what the factors are. I'm not sophisticated enough to understand. I go along with it and I say, okay, doc, whatever you say. Consent implies that I actually understand what's going on. I feel like I have equal power to the physician and that I am able to say yes or no. And I choose to say yes. That's the distinction that they make. And they argue that really in today's system, the structure of things is such that you're pretty much guaranteed that it's going to be assent more than consent. For a whole host of reasons, dealing with lack of medical sophistication on the part of patients, the fact that decisions tend to be made in crisis mode, the fact that the patient may not even be conscious and the relatives don't know what the patient wanted, and so on and so on. So there are different models that are now being proposed to actually replace patient autonomy. So some are arguing you should go back to the beneficence model because the doctor knows best anyway, and let him go by general social values. And others argue that no, you have to change your entire medical system so that the patient will know how to deal with these things beforehand and will have a long, lifelong experience of making decisions, and therefore they'll be able to make it themselves. Very interesting stuff. I can send you articles on it if you like, but I think now we have to finally get to the halacha, into the halacha side of this. What we've demonstrated are two key changes. Number one, changes in terms of the options on the table, including primarily physician-assisted death. And number two, change in terms of authority by shifting it to the patient. So the question is, what happens in halacha? So I want to address this by looking at two major halachic systems of dealing with end-of-life care. One, which I think is fair to call mainstream, the approach taken by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, by Rav Moshe Feinstein and others. And then second, one that I turn to a lot, although I don't think it's the dominant view, and that's the approach of Rav Herschel Schechter in dealing with these end-of-life situations. And we'll see whether social values make a dent in the way halacha approaches the situation. So the first approach, what I think of as probably the dominant approach in Orthodoxy, is an approach that says the most knowledgeable person involved has authority, which is generally going to be the doctor. Social values are not a factor, and social values do not change the options at the disposal of the halachic physician. This goes all the way back to the Gemara itself. If you take a look at source number 15, a Mishnah in Yuma dealing with the person who wants to fast on Yom Kippur, but is not medically capable. If someone is ill, we feed him based on the word of experts. What if I don't have an expert? Then we feed him based on his own say-so until he says, okay, I've had enough. And the Gemara plays this out on Daf Pei Gimel in Yuma and says that actually we err on the side of feeding. Meaning if the doctor says he needs it, we feed him. If the patient says he needs it, we feed him. And even if the doctor says, no, he doesn't need it, but the patient says, I'm starving, then we feed the patient. That's the halacha. But as a general rule, we do say that you go with the most expert individual involved. The only reason why the patient has credibility is because of the pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho. The heart knows, keyword is knows, the heart knows the its own bitterness. And therefore, he is actually considered to be knowledgeable, and that's why we're going to listen to him. We're not listening to him because of patient autonomy. We're listening to him because he is expert in his condition.
Have the final say as to whether he has to eat.
No. In the event that the doctor says he has to eat, he has to eat. Now, try getting food into him is another story without his cooperation. But that's the idea, is that we will compel him to eat.
There was a story I just read about Rav Steinman. He's now 103. He's fasted every year since his bar mitzvah. So this year, his personal doctor said he shouldn't eat. So Rav Steinman said to the doctor, tell me, have you ever treated anyone my age? The doctor said, no. So Simon said, therefore I take what you say as a suggestion, but not necessarily is that I have to listen to you.
But okay.
You know, that's a different story.
This is a different story of how you determine expertise.
Yeah.
Does it require experience? It's a good question in its own right.
Well, yeah. Food. You talk about physical food or like Bible too?
physical food. IV feeding on Yom Kippur is actually a very interesting topic, but beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. If you take a look at source number 16, you see how Ramban moves this idea forward. V'ika manda amar, this is from his Taras HaAdam, his classic work on medicine. He says, V'ika manda amar, there is a view that says, midiktani al pi bikiyin, that when it says we feed based on the experts, shmamina yachid mumcha umuchzak bibikiyus. That means an individual who is an expert, who is known to be expert. Mumcha literally actually means that he's approved, he's certified. And if there are other doctors who are not as expert, I added in the word in brackets, if they're on the other side, that we would actually go with expertise. In other words, Ramban says, there are those who argue, if there's one doctor who's brilliant and says, let's say, feed him, and there are 100 doctors who are not on his level, and they say, don't feed him, we would follow the one. But he says, Ve'eno Niri, he says, that does not appear to be correct. Shelo Shemanu B'Sanhedrin Shnelech HaCharov Chochma El'HaCharov Minyan. He says, when the Sanhedrin votes, they don't follow the most brilliant among them. You vote. You take a majority vote. Granted that he goes on to explain that the Sanhedrin functions differently from the way doctors are going to vote. There are certain rules that are unique to a Sanhedrin. But his basic statement is, and you can see the rest of the quote there in number 16, his basic statement at the end of the day is that if all the doctors are roughly equal, we're going to follow the majority. If you have one who has unique expertise in this regard, then that's who you're going to follow. So that the rule is, authority tends to be with education and expertise. There is that, you know, patient authority element of it, but again, it's really only a function of his knowledge. It's not a function of saying patient autonomy. It's not really about patient autonomy. Okay. Good. The emphasis on knowledgeable decision-making leads Rav Yaakov Emdin to a very interesting question. We're now fast-forwarding to Germany a couple of hundred years ago. Rav Yaakov Emdin asks the question, it's all well and good to say you go with the expert opinion. What if there is no expert? What if nobody really knows? Now what do? You have a patient who has a certain illness, and we think that this surgery would help him, but we don't have anybody who's willing to go on the record and say, I think that this is, my experience is that this is what we ought to do. So now what happens? That's the question that Rav Yaakov Emdin asks. So if you take a look at source number, in general, Rav Yaakov Emdin says, you have to listen to the doctor if he knows what he's doing. That's point number one. Point number two, though, is if the doctor's knowledge is uncertain and the patient has reason to do it differently, then in fact we'll let the patient decide. I'm just trying to figure out why I flipped these on the sheet. I'm going to go with number 19 and then number 18 because that's the chronological order. I'm not sure why I ever motioned first. Take a look at number 19, please. Rav Yaakov Emdin's statement on this. He says, Kasef Magen Avram. The Magen Avram wrote, Magen Avram was dealing with a Shabbos question about giving somebody a treatment that involves violating Shabbos, and the patient says, I don't want it. So the Magen Avram wrote, B'Shem Rad Baz, Shem Rofei Omer Tzarech, the doctor says the treatment is necessary. Im Lo Ratza HaChola LeKabel HaTrufa, if the patient doesn't want the medicine, Kofin Oso, it doesn't matter, we force him to have it. But Rav Yaakov Emdin says, Nira Li, it appears to me, Davka Kisher Rotza Limnoa Mishtamesh B'Refu'ah HaVadait, he says that's specifically where he wants you to refrain from treating him with a definite treatment, something that the doctors say, this is what we use and it always works. And in parentheses he says, Afas tamit alidei rofei mumcha kevadait chashiva. He says that which doctors normally give is automatically considered to be definite. That's what we mean, common medical knowledge. So the patient says, I don't want it because it's Shabbos, I don't want to have the treatment. That's where we don't listen to him. But if his reason for refusal is that he doesn't consider this to be a tested treatment, even if it's just on his own say-so, he says, doctor, I've seen this before, this doesn't work. Certainly if he has assistance back up from another doctor who also says, yeah, this treatment doesn't work, ain kofin, we don't force him. And certainly if he's afraid that this is actually going to harm him. So if the patient says, I am afraid of the treatment you're trying to give me, I think it's going to be bad for me, or the patient says, I don't think it works, the patient is actually able to abstain. Amram.
You said it was the treatment the doctor said. Now they're considered experts.
Yeah, so this actually is an interesting discussion going way, way back, centuries back, but the Chida already said, the Aruch HaShulchan seconded it, that that board certification constitutes an expert.
So then doctors, any doctor who gives any medication should be considered...
Consider Muncha, that's correct. Now, there may be issues of specialization. Yeah, there may be issues where you have someone who's seen 1,000 cases like this, and you have another doctor who practices in a small town and has never seen this since medical school. Yeah, there'll still be levels of expertise. But yes, certification by a board ordinarily constitutes mumcha status in halacha. So Rav Yaakov Emden makes the statement here that where the patient challenges the efficacy of it, and certainly where he's afraid that it may not work, the patient is able to refuse the treatment. Now take a look at what I brought you from Rav Moshe Feinstein in source number 18. Kisharov hu l'chayim. If most people who receive this treatment live, mistaber shechayev. So logically, the patient is obligated to accept the treatment. Kedekasav gam kvotavas harav misavara. Like he says, the person who asked him the question thought as well. Avo besafek hashakul. But where it's 50-50, and I don't believe he means literally 50-50, but where... it's kind of intermediate. Mistaber she'en l'chayvo. So logically, we should not obligate him to take the treatment. Dim u'chasa chayeshah shelo havadoin ve'ino rotzel ikanes besafik la'abed zeb bishvil safik she'aviach odzman vaday rashai. Because if he says, look, right now I know I have a few weeks or months or whatever it is to live, I'm afraid that if you treat me, I'm going to lose that. So he's entitled to say, I don't want to endanger my short-term life for the sake of a possibility of long-term life. He's allowed to do that. And Ramosha goes into a case which I'm going to skip right now, but one of the very interesting discussions in the Gemara in Sanhedrin about the possibility of endangering your short-term life for the sake of living long-term comes from, of all things, the story of the four Mitzorayim. If you remember the story, the four Mitzorayim are outside of the city. They're kicked out of the Jewish camp, and they're starving. And so they decide to go into what seems to be the abandoned non-Jewish city, figuring that maybe they'll get food there, or maybe they'll get killed, but right now they're going to die of starvation. And they go into the city. And the Gemara on that says that actually this was Gehazi and his three sons. And from that, which is very strange, because Gehazi is not a good guy in the Gemara, nonetheless, he is our model for saying, see, you're allowed to endanger your short-term life in pursuit of long-term survival. So the Rav Moshe on this says, I'm actually really surprised that that's what we would that we would use as our basis. He has a whole argument in here, and his conclusion is. His conclusion is that in fact a person is allowed to endanger himself for the sake of it goes both ways. He's allowed to endanger his short-term life for the sake of long-term life, and he's allowed to enter into risky situations, deciding for himself that that's the risk he's willing to take. So basically what this means is authority is with the one who is most knowledgeable. And that would tend to be the doctor. So it doesn't change, even though in general society the belief is now that the patient should be the one who says. The factors that are taken into consideration also don't seem to be about any social values or shift in social values either, and the options don't appear to change as well. That's based on Ramban from the Gemara and Rav Yaakov Emden. What about moving forward into the 20th century and the way that this plays out? So authority hasn't changed. They still take the same view that it's the doctor who's going to make the decision. That has not shifted. In the realm of options, by the way, let me just actually make a step back, because I think something that I said may not have been clear. It is true that the proponents of this view may say, I want to ask my rabbi what I ought to do. But that's not an overriding of the doctor's authority, because the rabbi ultimately is going to rely on the doctor to tell him this is what's actually happening, to give him the medical facts. The rabbi is going to tell him, so halacha will say, we think that we should do X, or we should do Y. But if the halacha is, let's say the halacha is, treat the patient, it's the doctor who's going to define what treating is. That doesn't change the fact that the authority is fundamentally with the physician. Okay. The options for treating actually have changed within this school of thought. This Rav Moshe, Rav Shlomo Zalman, and so on school of thought. The options have changed, but it's not a function of social values changing. It's for a different reason. And that is because of new medical technology and new knowledge. It's really a side point within the shir, but you can't really give the shir without noting it, because it's not really about social values changing. It's the fact that our new technologies have given us a greater ability than ever before to extend life without healing disease. Historically, there was only so far you could go in terms of treating symptoms, and ultimately the patient was going to succumb to the disease. We are now much better at being able to mitigate things. You can give patients treatment for tumors that will keep them from growing for a very long period of time, while keeping the patient alive. The patient might be suffering, but the patient will live. There are all sorts of things that we are now able to do. And as a result of that, you find within this school of thought a distinction between healing and extending pain. If you take a look at source number 21, actually source number 20, Rav Moshe first, do it in chronological order. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote in source number 20, "Ubedvarim mechuyav hachola likanes b'sakanas hachayei shah b'shvil savek chayim haragilin le'inshi." Is a patient obligated to endanger temporary life for the sake of living a longer term life? Hang on, I just want to see if that was the one that I wanted. I'm just looking at what I have on my sheet, but you know what? That wasn't the source that I wanted. So never mind number 20. I apologize. I think I was trying to do something else with that. It's not this point. Jump to 21, to Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman writes, talking about an amputation of a second leg of somebody who they're not able to cure. Ein levatzei anituach kazeh neged ritzono shel hachole. He says, do not conduct such an operation against the will of the patient. He says, don't even try to convince him to undergo this surgery. You're talking about a great and dangerous surgery. It is only going to make him suffer more, without any chance that he's actually going to live long term. The tshuva I wanted to bring for Rav Moshe is a separate tshuva, but he takes the same stance. There are some distinctions between Rav Shlomo Zalman's position and Rav Moshe's position, but fundamentally, this is not a response to social values changing. It's a statement that healing isn't really happening here. And to show you some remarkable support for it, take a look at source number 22, where Rav Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler, said, this goes back to Shulchan Aruch, this isn't a new idea. Biker hayisod, de koma she'efsher laharich chayei hacholeh, he says, in terms of this basic foundation, that as long as you can extend the life of the patient, even temporarily, you have to do it. He says, when I was a kid, I heard people say that. But I don't know if it came from anybody that you would rely on. But I think it requires great examination. Because the Shulchan Aruch says explicitly, you're allowed to remove something that is keeping the patient from dying. If he, the patient, is suffering greatly because he's not being allowed to die. I'm not allowed to do anything to his body, but other than that, I'm allowed to. So then why should I engage in all possible treatments to extend the life of the patient? That's the argument that the Stipler gave from the Shulchan Aruch. So the options have changed, but I don't think it's a response to changes in social values. The only area where I think something might be subject to a change in social values is this very interesting quote from Rav Shlomo Zalman in number 23. He writes, "Mistaber, it will be logical to say, she'im ha'choles sovel mike'evim v'yisurim gedolim, that if the patient is suffering from great pain, oh, afilu sevel nefesh chazak me'od, or even great emotional pain, choshvani she'ochel v'chamtzan l'nshima chayavim litein lo gam neged ritzon." Now he says, I think you always have to give him oxygen and food. That was Shlomo Zalman's position down the line. No matter, even if he refuses, but you would be allowed to refrain from medicine that causes the patient to experience pain, to suffer. Did you catch what Shlomo Zalman threw in there? There was a factor he included which we haven't seen before. I've been monologuing a lot. Sorry?
Mental anguish.
Yeah, sevel nefesh. Mental emotional pain. Rav Shlomo Zalman just slipped that one in there. I have not seen that in an earlier source. The idea that that's a consideration. I don't know if that's a function of our times or if that's what he held always had been the case, but I think it's a remarkable point that has to be recognized. Yes. Yes, it is. It's entirely his, I don't know what to call it. I don't want to call it Sfarat Keres. That would not be appropriate. But it's his, yeah. So within this school of thought, authority doesn't change. Factors that we consider, maybe the factor of emotional pain, might be something that's a response. Options change, but again, I don't think it's a function of social values. That's one school. And then you have this other school of thought of Rav Schechter on what happens in treating somebody in this sort of a situation. Rav Schechter wrote this up in an article in the journal Beis Yitzchak in the 1980s. It's since appeared in other places as well. Rav Schechter's condition is very much on the side of patient and society being the ones to determine whether to continue, and it will always fluctuate based on the particular day, the particular era that you're in. Not to the point of allowing anyone to do anything to actively end the life of a patient, meaning the treating options remain as they were. Treat, withhold, palliate. He is more lenient in terms of what you can withhold than others. He doesn't require that you give food and oxygen where the patient doesn't want it. But take a look at the logic. He traces patient autonomy back to the Gemara. It's source number 24. The Gemara is talking about the obligation to pay your workers on time. And the Pasuk says that you have to pay them on time. They love who noseas nafsho. This pauper who you have employed is looking towards this salary for his survival. He puts his life on the line for this salary. Says the Gemara, "Mipnei ma ola zeba kevesh v'nisle ba'ilon?" Why did this person climb the ramp, hang from the tree, umaser es atzmo lamisa, and give himself up for death? Not literally, he's not dead, or you wouldn't be paying him. You'd be paying the estate. But the point is, why did he put his life on the line? Lo al scharo. Isn't it for the sake of his salary? That's what the Gemara says. So before Rav Schechter, Poskim have already looked at this and said, this is the basis for the cost-benefit analysis, to say you are allowed to take certain risks in the event that there is a worthwhile benefit on the other side, and we make it contingent on what people normally will do. What Rav Schechter does, that I think is an extension of it, is to say that that's true in terms of end-of-life care and a person saying, I don't want to be treated. that a person is entitled to say, I don't want this. And if most people would be like that, if most people, and it's not about Jews, if most human beings would say, I don't want this kind of care, or, I shouldn't say it that way, let's actually read it from the article, because it's more subtle than that. Source 25. This is from his summation. V'yotzei ledina shlagimol chilukei ofanim yesh. He says, as a matter of law, there are three categories. Aleph. Hecha de'ika umdina demuchach shekol adam hayarotze b'tipul refu'izeh. Where there is an umdina demuchach, which I will translate as, it is very clear. Okay? It is very clear that everybody would want this treatment. Then we say this individual's refusal is void. I don't care about his refusal. You would force him to the extent that you can force somebody to engage in medical treatment. Good luck. But you know, that's his statement. Because he has an obligation to guard his life. That's category one, where everybody would want this. He has to go along with it. Base. In the event that you know that nobody would want this kind of a treatment, then you're not allowed to treat him. Not allowed, because you're torturing him. If nobody would want this, he's not allowed to volunteer for it. That's the opposite extreme. And then you have your middle category. Where you don't have 100% who would want this treatment, and you don't have 100% who would not want this treatment. And by the way, 100 doesn't literally mean 100, or else you wouldn't have him as the exception. The 100 doesn't mean 100. What does it mean is a really good question. And I don't think you can solve it with math. I think it's much more of a feel than a number. But he says if you can't tell that it's for sure that they would have it, or for sure they wouldn't have it, as hadavar taloi bidas hachole. It depends on what the patient wants. It's not about what the doctor recommends. It's not about the person who has the greatest knowledge of cases being the one to determine it. The patient has the right, even if the doctor says, look, take this and I know you'll be better, and I think this is what you should do. The patient has the ability to be the deciding voice on that. So, number one, I find this interesting because he puts authority with the patient. Number two, because it takes into consideration social values. It's what society would want, which is going to change. What society wants in 2017 is not what society wanted in 1967, and it's not what society will want necessarily in 2067. He's saying this is like Kavod HaBrios that we said in the beginning, right? Or like Beged Isha, where social values will determine the application of the halacha. So what we've seen in this, and then I want to end with one question that I can't resolve, but what we've seen here is there are various laws in which social values do matter, like Kavod HaBrios, like Beged Isha, like the type of clothing you wear for davening. Those areas, social values matter. In medical decision making, social values have changed, broadening the options available for treatment, broadening the factors perhaps which people consider maybe, and shifting the authority making the decision from the most knowledgeable to the patient. In halacha, we have different schools on medical decision making. The approach of Shlomo Zalman, Rav Moshe Feinstein, going back to the Ramban, is primarily knowledge based. You go with the doctor, but in the event that the doctor doesn't know, then you have the patient autonomy, the ability of the patient to make the decision. According to this school of thought, the options have not changed, although we have the interesting development of distinguishing between healing and prolonging pain with our newer technology. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman seems to add a factor of emotional pain. And it's hard for me to say whether that's a response to contemporary values or not. And then on the other end, you have the approach of Rav Schechter, which is built around social values entirely, and it makes it very subjective. such that in this middle ground where you can't say for sure no one would want this, you can't say for sure everybody would want it, authority really is with the patient to make the decision, and social values are a key factor in making that that decision. The question that I remain with is this. We talked about Kavod HaBriyos before. We talked about dignity before. The social value swing now argues that it's basic to human dignity to be able to make decisions about your own medical care. That's the definition of human dignity. I don't think most people believe that, to be entirely honest. I still think that, just based on my experience when I've been a patient, and from visiting people in hospitals and so on, I think that the drive to have patients be the ones to make the decision is still much more about fear of lawsuits than it is about, well, this is a human being in front of us and he should make the decision about his care. But let's say we lived in a society in which, in fact, autonomy would be declared a matter of dignity. People would grow up feeling like it's an offense against my personhood for somebody to make the decision on my behalf. Would that become part of Kavod HaBriyos?
There's a whole realm of things that the law would not allow, even if I think.
Correct. It would have to be within bounds. But the question is, would that now shift within bounds? Within, you know, we're not violating Del Reisos and so on. But would this allow the, not allow, would this require physicians to ask patients what they want? I think it's a very interesting idea. Yeah, Ellie.
Just to go to the one comment that you made, that every doctor... pretty much every person in society would consider the doctor to be immoral. Not that he's liable to a lawsuit, but just immoral if he doesn't tell the patient everything. You know, with some exceptions.
Right.
Tell the patient what's going on with them. I think people look at you like you're crazy, like you're a bad person.
Right, but on the other hand, if you have a doctor who says, they have a patient in front of them, and they say, you know, I think he needs surgery. And the patient says, well, I'd rather just take aspirin. And the doctor says to the patient, what you need is surgery, and I will not continue, you know, I'll find somebody else, I'll refer you to somebody else, I will not continue as your doctor in the event that you don't go with surgery.
Yeah.
That statement from the doctor... that the doctor makes is not considered an offense to his autonomy. Or when, to use a more accurate, not accurate, but to use a more current issue, when the doctor says, you better vaccinate yourself and your kids, right, and I won't be your doctor anymore if you don't, no one considers that an offense to the patient's autonomy.
Is everybody free to choose what they want to do? The doctor chooses what he wants to do, the patient chooses what he wants to do.
But I'm saying it's not considered an offense to their dignity.
No.
So that's the need for morality in terms of the patient being informed of things is separate from the demand for consent. I don't think the two things are the same. You know, that's what I'm getting at. I think you're right. I think it's today it's considered offensive for a doctor to be dishonest with a patient. What Hippocrates said, what the CMA said in 1868, will no longer fly. But I don't think that's the same thing as saying, and the patient has to be the one to make the decision about what his care is going to be. I don't know that that's the same thing. I don't know. These things are very tricky. I don't think it's. I wonder what will happen in a world in which that's actually a function of dignity. Your dignity is that you are the ones who make to make the decision about your care. I'm not really sure.
We also see get a lot of stuff like online.
Yeah, doctors love that. That's the best way to make a friend of your doctor. I saw on the internet. Exactly. So, God willing, next week Rabbi Ziering will give the shiur in this series. I don't remember what his topic is, but I'm certain it's excellent. And in 2 weeks, I will be back to speak about changes in the way that we deal with the chote, as a response to religious values within the community.